Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education and Higher Education Academy webinar. Are you ready for the Teaching Excellence Framework? I'm Chris Havergal. I'm a reporter covering teaching and learning at Times Higher Education. Today I'm joined by Stephanie Marshall, who's Chief Executive of the HEA. Stephanie is also Professor of Higher Education at the University of Manchester and co-editor and author of several publications, most recently A Handbook for Leaders in Higher Education, Transforming Teaching and Learning. I'm also joined by Julie McLeod. She's the Pro Vice Chancellor for Student Experience at Oxford Brookes University. She joined Brookes after a biomedical science research career at the University of the West of England and also the Universities of Bristol and Bath. In her current role, she leads implementation of Oxford Brookes' strategy for enhancing the student experience, focusing on areas such as learning analytics, mentoring and inclusion. And our panel is completed by Stephen Isherwood. He's Chief Executive of the Association of Graduate Recruiters. And prior to that role, he was head of graduate recruitment in the UK and Ireland for Ernst & Young, one of the biggest graduate recruiters in the UK. I hope today's session will be useful for everyone to explain not only what the Teaching Excellence Framework is and how it will work, but also how institutions can best prepare themselves for it. I'll begin by leading a discussion with our panel covering some of these key themes, but I really do want to hear the views of people listening in on today's session, and you should through your web browser be able to ask questions. I'll take a look at them, and during the course of our session I'll offer them to the panel. Firstly, it might be useful just for me to explain why we're talking about the Teaching Excellence Framework, or indeed the TEF, as I'll call it. It's very timely to be discussing it. The government's white paper on higher education was published just last week, confirming the government's intention to push ahead with the TEF, which it sees as a way of raising the status of teaching in English universities, addressing what it believes have been patchy teaching standards, and giving students more information about standards at our universities. There's plenty of information in the white paper about the TEF, and we'll cover some of that during today's session. Certainly what was in there was the confirmation that universities will be able to volunteer to take part in the TEF if they meet certain eligibility criteria, having passed a recent QAA review or similar, and having a commitment to widening participation. It confirmed that there'll be measures according to a series of metrics on student outcomes, covering student satisfaction, retention, and graduate employment, and as well, submissions of evidence from institutions will be considered by independent panels alongside these metrics. The panel will then determine whether a university should be considered to have fitted into one of three categories, whether it meets expectations, is excellent, or is considered to be outstanding. Those three ratings will determine the tuition fee rise, which universities will be eligible for. Institutions which meet expectations will be eligible for 50% of inflation, while the top two categories will be eligible for 100% of inflation. Those ratings will last for 3 years. Just finally, there was some good news for the sector, it should be said in the white paper, with the government confirming that it would phase in the implementation of the TEF. In the first year, QAA judgments will allow for the inflationary fee rise. In the second year, it will now be a pilot year, and all institutions which meet expectations will be eligible for that inflationary fee rise. But the fee link, which was a contentious issue for some universities, will remain, coming into force in the third year of the TEF. And there's perhaps a sting in the tail as well. While if your TEF rating is maintained, your fees will be able to go up. If your TEF rating goes down, you'll be made to reduce your fees. Of course, I've been talking about England here mostly, but universities in the rest of the UK are likely to be able to volunteer to take part in at least the first stages of the TEF, perhaps not eligible for the financial benefits, but it may be that the reputational benefits prove very attractive. I want to open up the debate and get our conversation started, and what I'll do to begin with is go round our panel just to get some opening thoughts from them. Stephanie Marshall, I was wondering if I could start with you. I wanted to know whether you thought the TEF was moving in the right direction, whether it was now something that the sector could engage with.
I think it's certainly part of a journey, and I think that's really, really important in terms of raising the status of teaching. As the champion for higher education over the past 10 years, we've always been trying to drive teaching excellence. How have we done this? Well, we've worked with 26 countries across the globe. We've now got over 75,000 fellows which is approximately one-third of the academic staff. We've got 120 higher education institutions now that have CPD schemes, so institutions that are really concerned to make sure that their staff remain in good practice through continuous professional development. And we also have an extensive research of what works and doesn't work as a result of working closely with the sector over this past decade. I see the TEF being very much as providing foundation and a framework on which to build and continue the journey for teaching excellence. And I have to applaud the fact that it is an opportunity to bring about greater parity for STEAM with research.
Great. No, thanks very much for that, Stephanie. I mean, Julie, perhaps I could come to you, Julie McLeod from Oxford Brookes. I mean, can I ask, what did an institution like yours make of plans for the TEF? You know, do you now think that this is something that is moving in the right direction for the sector?
Well, certainly the white paper and the associated technical consultation are welcome from our perspective, although rather long documents. And for us, where we saw the green paper, we very much relished the challenge of highlighting the work that we do in ensuring an excellent learning environment, and thus we do feel that the publication of the white paper is very welcome. I think it's also should be highlighted that it's clear from the paper that the consultation, which was extremely well informed by the sector in quantity, if not quality as well, has directly informed the white paper, and one can see it very, very clearly throughout all aspects of the white paper. And indeed, the work which the Higher Education Academy Pro-Vice Chancellor Network undertook, particularly on the TEF criteria in ensuring appropriate stretch and aspiration, is now much better and more clearly articulated. And as Stephanie highlighted, the overall emphasis on the wider learning environment rather than the delivery method of just teaching is rightly appropriate to a fulsome university experience. We also welcome the fact that for us, the support for social mobility from access to achievement and an employer-informed curriculum were rightly at the core of the TEF, and it was pleasing to see that our FE Further Education College partners will now be able to attain their own recognition of excellence of their learning environment, which I felt was a welcome change from the Green Paper and showed the input from consultation. As you highlighted at the beginning, the recognition of the benefit of a slower approach to full implementation of TEF rightly acknowledges the value of a paced approach, particularly when the metrics we can utilize are proxies at best, and most universities will feel that the National Student Survey, the NSS, aligns in a loose way with the quality of the learning environment. However, it is rightly acknowledged in the papers that the metrics around employability and career trajectory are poor proxies. And as evidence of research from recently, the Institute of Fiscal Studies, it highlighted the myriad factors of which universities have little if any impact on employability, and for example, cultural capital, and the work of the Bristol-based Paired Peers Research highlights the issues very well, and that's, I'm very supportive of the work asked of the sector in developing better metrics for graduate outcomes. I'm sure Stephen will highlight some of those thoughts which are already out there. Now, the other point really from our perspective is metrics can over time lead to a herd mentality in chasing numerical scores, and this really challenging what I think is the key ethos of the TEF, which is the excellence, which one would see within a dynamic and agile sector. And therefore, the contextual element of the TEF will be critical in ensuring different missions are best recognized. And I'm hopeful that the lessons learned aspect of the TEF consultation year two need to be and should be pivotal in ensuring the panel are best able to recognize and celebrate diversity, and also importantly, to ensure the development of clear criteria for the panel's evaluation of the metrics and benchmark. So with those views, that's our initial view, but really overall, very welcome.
Julie, thanks very much for that. Plenty there to discuss later during the session, I'm sure. Turning finally then to Stephen Ishwood from the Association of Graduate Recruiters. A lot of the discussion about the TEF, Stephen, has been very, very focused on what it will mean for universities, how they're going to respond to it. But it's really important to get a sense of what it might mean for employers, how they have reacted or how they are likely to react to plans for the TEF, how it's going to change what they do. I wondered if you could give us some opening thoughts on that theme.
Yes, certainly. I mean, overall, from where I sit, we consider the TEF a good thing. Greater focus on teaching quality, transparency for students is a good thing because it should lead to better employment outcomes. Employees do accept that the university experience, it is about co-creation, it is about mutuality of achievement. I think there's any issues with that, but I think the question that we come at that from is where's the balance in that power? And actually, when you look at what the TEF is doing in terms of creating more knowledge and information to get into, to be made available to students, particularly those students who are making choices about what they study and where they study, I think is a good thing. Because one of the things that we often forget about the UK, and I repeat this so much, I bore myself actually, is around so many employers just don't really care what somebody studies, which is so different to almost any other market. I mean, 71% of the employers we work with do not stipulate a degree discipline. You know, in the UK, you can do a classics degree and become a lawyer, an accountant, a doctor. You know, the routes to do that and converse are there, which they aren't in other countries. But that creates a lot of ambiguity. When it comes to young people making their decisions about what they study and how they study, etc., because actually the outcomes related to what you study are a lot murkier. I think that creates a lot of inefficiencies because we shouldn't forget that last year 45% of employers didn't fill all their graduate vacancies. They could have hired more people. So although the skills debate, the skills gap has been talked about, you know, ad infinitum, it is reality. There are employers who could recruit more people if they could find the right people with the right knowledge, skills, attributes, etc. And I think the parts of the TEF that help that are definitely very much a good thing. Because I think there's two pretty powerful forces being unleashed. In the TEF itself, and the other is the apprentice levy. The longitudinal educational outcomes data, that linking of outcomes based on salaries, as crude as it is, back to what you studied and where you studied it, will be provide a lot more data than the Delhi does. The Delhi is a very crude measure, partly because it talks about categories of employment. It doesn't talk about sectors of employment. Or what specific jobs you've done, whether you've done an engineering degree or a media degree or a history degree. So I think that will provide a lot more information to students. And also the apprentice levy. The apprentice levy has the potential to significantly change employee behaviours because there has been a considerable move over the last few years of employers looking more and more at school leaver programmes. So looking at our data for this year, the rise in graduate vacancies has plateaued a bit. Graduate vacancies this year were only up 2% according to our data, whereas apprentice level vacancies up nearly 25%, albeit from a much lower base. So it's not just about the TEF, that's my final point. It's not just about the TEF, it's about other forces active in the employer market that could drive significant change into the way the connection between schools, education, higher education, and then into employment outcomes, particularly if you look at taking sort of a 5 to 10 year view.
Stephen, thanks for that. Several of our speakers so far have talked about the TEF metrics. So perhaps a good place to start really digging into the detail of the TEF is on those metrics. As I said, the government has confirmed its plan to stick with three core metrics for the opening stages of the TEF, satisfaction, retention, and graduate employment. On satisfaction, the government proposes that it would look at questions from the National Student Survey, focusing on teaching assessment and feedback and academic support for students. On retention, it would look at data held by the Higher Education Statistics Agency, basically looking at the proportion of students that get through the first year of their studies and continue their studies beyond that. And then in terms of employment, the main source at the start at least, would be the Destinations of Leavers of Higher Education survey, looking at the proportion of an institution students who are working or in further study 6 months after graduation. Perhaps one of the most significant points which was made in the white paper was confirming that all of these metrics will be benchmarked for institutions. So rather than taking the raw figure, it will sort of look at how an institution is doing compared to the students that it has, and broken down by issues such as socioeconomic background, ethnicity, gender, all of those things that we know can have an effect on issues such as retention and graduate employment. And another key point that was made was that rather than looking at data for a single year, the government proposes to look at 3-year averages for these sort of key metrics. And in addition, these metrics will also be broken down by key characteristics such as gender and ethnicity, etc. So panels making judgments, you know, will be able to see how institutions are doing in those areas. That's the start of the TEF, but for later years, the metrics could evolve. The government has said it's certainly looking at introducing a measure of what proportion of a university's or higher education provider's students go into skilled employment using classifications held by the Office for National Statistics. And the government is also looking, as Stephen mentioned, I think, to build a more sort of sophisticated metric of graduate employment using tax records. Later on, there could also be metrics in areas such as contact hours, and also while the TEF would only look at undergraduate courses in the first instance, it's likely that in year four we'd get taught postgraduate courses in there as well. And perhaps in terms of discussion, we could start with those core metrics around satisfaction, retention and graduate employment. Stephanie, I wondered if I could come to you first. Those three core metrics, do you think that that's a fair reflection of teaching excellence as the HEA understands it? Are those metrics going to give that fair reflection?
I think there's a key issue around, we know that great teaching is a key driver of student success. So when you're looking particularly at those metrics, and I have to say we've debated those metrics long and hard in the national press, we've certainly debated them within the PVC TEF working group that Julie referred to, and I think it's how you nuance those as well. We've got a series of frameworks that over 100 HEIs have helped us develop, and those frameworks are on, for example, assessment and feedback, they're on retention, they're on employability, so they will help institutions consider how they take forward embedding those key skills and within the curriculum and how they make improvements over the years. I think certainly the white paper recognizes, as you rightly said, the need for new metrics that will better capture student outcomes. And certainly one of the metrics that we've been involved very heavily working with the sector on is the UKES, the UK Engagement Survey. What is it that students say make the greatest difference in terms of their outcomes, and what really helps in terms of learning gain as they progress through their 3 years of their program? I think if institutions aren't already using UKES, it's really important that they should do not start looking at it now, if only in preparation for TEF 3, because it will give them a better sense of what data, for example, around course challenge could be useful metrics to look at further down the line. So we will work very closely with our PVC network as well in terms of what might be more appropriate metrics, and I think that's where TEF will evolve.
Great. Julie, can I come to you for a sort of institutional perspective? Do you think that the metrics that are proposed at the moment will reflect the sort of the quality of teaching at Oxford Brookes, or are you concerned that you know, they will not capture that full picture and indeed, as some people have suggested, reflect more the sort of the types of students you have and the type of courses you offer as opposed to the quality of your teaching?
Well, I think it's one of those interesting aspects, because these are the metrics we have, and therefore they're the metrics that we end up be using. And as Stephanie usefully highlighted, I think there is work to be done on looking at making sure that these are reviewed and do fully reflect. I think certainly the National Student Survey is one which, when I've talked to peers across the universities, is one where we feel that maybe aligns to a certain extent with quality, and it rightfully puts the students at the centre of that. Of course, student cohort mix and such like is going to have an impact on that, and whether you have more distance learners than those who are actually on campus. But I think certainly as an initial start, the NSS and retention give a little bit of a view, but I think importantly for me is always that wider aspect of the contextual, because otherwise one does get very focused on teaching as a delivery, and actually at university level it's that learning environment which sits within the lecture and tutorials, but actually more widely as well. So the metrics will only be able to capture certain aspects of that, and I do think there is work to be done. And really to follow on from NSS being reviewed, and I think that's right and appropriate, and I think many of the questions that they've now done will make it even better. And I do agree with Stephanie around the engagement survey. We've used this, and the aspect that has been the most powerful for me was the students coming back and saying that the questions made them reflect on their learning patterns, which to a certain extent comes into some of the HEPI surveys that come forward. So I think there is certainly benefit in looking at a range of metrics that we can capture from the students to get the best awareness of the teaching quality. And then also, you know, as we do, identify areas that we need to work on or indeed celebrate.
Thanks, Julie. I mean, Stephen, I wondered if you could give me a sense, to what extent are employers already looking at these sorts of pieces of data, because they already all exist. To what extent are employers looking at them at the moment, or do you think that the TEF will make employers, look at this issue anew? Are they the sorts of issues which could potentially be important for employers?
I think they could be, but I don't think it will start to get any real traction until we start to look at years 3 and 4. Once you start getting data by discipline, I think data at an institution level will be so generic as employers aren't that engaged in the whole TEF conversation at the moment anyway, because when you start to talk about time scales about around 4 years away, well, that's kind of too long on the horizon. It's similar to a bit, I think, around the GPA conversation I've been involved in. Until it becomes a reality for most institutions, actually organizations, employers, that it's not naturally going to be at the forefront of their minds. There's some really interesting moves that are happening with employers, because actually you're starting to see employers, some move away from crude measures they've used in the past, UCAS tariffs, et cetera, and starting to look at other ways of using data around the people they might hire to try and predict actually what those outcomes can be. So aligning the TEF to those. So ideas of learning gain, I find fascinating. That's something I really want to read up on, and I'm involved in one of the projects around it, because employers want people on an upward trajectory, people who have, who are continually improving, they're lifelong learners, they're able to reflect. And I think if we can get a learning gain measure that is meaningful, that actually, again, might help employers look more closely at it. But most employers, the data they've got to go off is the data they have of people they've hired in the past. So actually what they do is they look at who they've hired in the past and work out who's been successful. Of course, the real problem with that is you don't know who you didn't hire. So actually getting employees to take a risk and going outside maybe the conventions of how they hired in the past is challenging. But areas around contextualized data, differential offers, all that kind of stuff. Some of that is also gaining traction with employers. It very much depends on the employer and the sector.
Great. Stephanie, I wondered if I could come back to you. I just wondered sort of how you thought the sector had responded to these metrics being proposed. Are people sort of concerned about sort of greater weight being put on these, or is it the case that actually already, the sector is already doing a lot? There can't be a university in the country which doesn't focus on retention, on satisfaction, on graduate employment. Is it actually the case that people, shouldn't be as concerned as perhaps they may be?
I think we've seen the debate in, as I say, the public press, have we not, in terms of could there be better metrics? But I think we keep coming back to these are three that are in existence, and certainly in discussions with BEARS, consultation further to the Green Paper, it was a matter of saying, well, okay, we're stuck, but we are working on developing new metrics, and we will continue to look at other more appropriate metrics. And, you know, Stephen's saying, actually, it'll be interesting when we have a learning gain measure. And, you know, the number of institutions working on those pilots, working that up, and certainly the UKES gives some sort of a metric as well. I think at the end of the day, and Julie might correct me on this one in terms of how the sector feels, but the sense I get even from our PVCs is we've got those three metrics, but we've also done a huge amount to work on what, particularly the assessment and feedback aspect of the NSS. And I think we can see that despite any of the concerns about the NSS, institutions do agree that certainly assessment and feedback, which had regularly featured as a poor result on from the perspective of students, has been worked at an awful lot, and great improvements have been made. We've got a number of different tools that have helped. For example, the tester tool has been used across all sorts of institutions to be able to drive up assessment and feedback satisfaction from students. I think just the fact that we've had over 100 universities engaging with us saying we want to get even better retention, therefore what might a framework and an audit tool look like to help us ensure we've got certain things in place so that we are engaging students more and we are retaining them, we are obviating any of the difficulties they might have of being on campus, engaging with their studies, etc. We've also got, I have to say, I'm very proud of all the research that Paul Hamlin funded over the years on the What Works series. And certainly we've worked closely with Offa on looking at best practice in retention. Then when we get to employability, once again, it's, you know, what does that look like when it's been embedded in the curriculum? And my sense is over the past 10 years, we've got much better now at looking at things like employability in the curriculum. But by looking at the discipline level, because it was just too much for institutions to say, we've got an employability framework, everybody needs to adhere to this. Instead, working with groups of staff from across the different disciplines has really helped embed that. Things like the HEAR, the Higher Education Achievement Report, what are the higher level skills that are really contributing to student employability has been incredibly useful. So we've got a range of initiatives that, in terms of partnering with the sector, I think these three areas have been live issues that the sector has really wanted to work with us on through our different networks and different working groups to address. And I think we've come an awful long way. That isn't to say we've cracked it, and we will continue to move forward. And I guess metrics will continue to evolve. And we say, what is it that this key issue that we really do need to crack to get students fully engaged so that also tutors are able to work with the students in terms of self-monitoring and the progress that they might need to achieve student successful outcomes.
Great. I mean, it's definitely putting a lot of emphasis there on development of the TEF over time and potentially development of future metrics. I just wanted to close on this by turning either to Julie or Stephen, really, to ask whether there were other metrics which they thought could come into the TEF in later years, or indeed should come into the TEF in later years. Stephen mentioned learning gain, i.e. sort of the distance travelled by students during their time at university, but I just wondered if there were suggestions of any others.
If I can go, because I think one of the things, Prospect did some work a couple of years ago, and we matched it to CBI data. And it was around actually what it was students who had graduated and started work, so were in work a year after graduating. And it was a fascinating piece of work because it showed that actually they were asked what skills they needed now they were in work, what skills their employer needed, and actually what skills they had on university. And it showed quite a significant mismatch. Now, I don't know if this is achievable, but one of the difficulties of asking students about employability, unless they've had a significant placement experience, it's very difficult for them to actually put their university experience in the context of the world of work. So I don't know if it's possible, but having something that actually measures people where they're close enough still to their student life to be able to remember what it was like to be a student, but actually are more informed so can give a better analysis actually of what, if they were to, let's say, you know, what could they feed back into the system to do things differently. Now they're a little bit more experienced and understand better around what the world of work is like.
Well, certainly that's something that I think Higher Education Statistics Agency has been considering as it looks to revamp its Delhi Destinations of Leaders of Higher Education survey. So certainly one to look out for something along those lines. And Julie, perhaps just finally come to you, whether there was anything in particular that you thought could come in, or indeed whether there was anything that you'd be concerned about coming in, such as, you know, contact hours. That's one of the things that has been suggested as a metric.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and there are a number of areas, just as both Stephanie and Stephen have highlighted, where we could look at the metrics. And I think it's always very important to make sure that those metrics really do align to what we're expecting here. So a lot of the metrics we're discussing here will inform the TEF, which is teaching excellence. We're not talking about standards. We have that aspect that will be annually monitored, and indeed previously was monitored every 5 years from the quality assurance that we do. And so we do need to make sure that whatever metrics come forward really truly align with what we're expecting from them as the trajectory, the journey that the students take. So one aspect, talking particularly around the learning gain that Stephen mentioned, and this is a very intriguing aspect because, of course, we know that our students have making a transition from, in more cases than none, from level four up to a level six for an undergraduate, because we're, for those mature institutions that have a QAA, we look at the level and attainment, and a strong assessment score then aligns to the learning outcomes that have to be generating. Every algorithm that has a degree outcome will have a predominance around the level six and that critical analysis and that degree level graduate. But what we don't assess in many cases, although I have to acknowledge some very strong practice-based programs of work do, for example, some of the nursing and some of the architecture, is around attributes and skills. And that's actually what the employers are looking for, is a student who can articulate and feel confident around their own attributes and skills, and also has a resilience around understanding how best to work within a team and such like. So I think many of the learning gain projects that are currently being supported by both the HEA's Vice-Chancellor's Initiative and HEFCE will be very interesting in seeing how we can best align both assessment of skills and attributes to make sure that we can get a differential, but most importantly, as Stephen highlighted, that the students best understand those skills that they have attained and which are very clear to us as academics, but are less clear to students who have been on that journey and maybe don't have that full reflection all the way back.
Great. I'd like to say at this point to thank everyone who's submitted questions so far for the panel. We'll come to them very shortly, so please keep them coming. You should be able to submit them via your web browser. I did just want to cover just the other half of how the TEF is going to work. We've talked about the metrics. As well as this, there's the contextual information. Several of our speakers have referenced this already. It won't just be about metrics. In order to reflect the diverse missions and approaches of universities, providers will also be allowed to submit up to 15 pages of evidence, which will be considered alongside the metrics by an independent panel in order to decide which TEF category a provider will be placed into. The white paper has many suggestions of the sorts of things that institutions could include in their submissions. As we've heard already, the UK engagement survey, evidence around learning gain, and indeed contact hours. But there's also other points in there, for example, recognition of providers' courses by professional bodies, the work that the provider is doing around grade point average to give a more granular picture of students' achievement, and indeed support for entrepreneurship inside an institution. Julia, I wondered if I could come back to you to start, really, to see if you were able to give a sense of the sorts of things that maybe Oxford Brookes might put into a institutional submission for the TEF, or indeed the sorts of things that you thought, you know, other people perhaps should be considering.
Well, certainly from Oxford Brookes' point of view, we felt it was vitally important that, because this is the teaching excellence framework, that contextual documentation was able to give a view of that strategic level of embedding and how staff are engaged with ensuring innovation and change of practice takes place. And so certainly from our point of view, we would be expecting to be highlighting our own, how we implement our student experience strategy that we have, which is through a project-based approach, of which we've already embedded, and people will be aware that we've already implemented GPA, and a number of other projects which are cross-institutional. All staff across the institution are also involved, and it gets that complete buy-in to how do we best make sure that we are enabling the best learning environment for our students. And a number of ones that we areas that we're currently working on where we have learning analytics for success rather than risk, which is quite a different way of looking at things. And particularly when I think about the learning analytics, it's around an aspect that you highlighted, which is about breaking down our metrics and really looking at the diversity and how individuals and how students at different areas, whether that is female, male, et cetera, how they best undertake their studies and how we can best ensure that they can attain the best that they possibly can. So for us, we are looking forward to being able to put forward our strategic approach. Within that, there would also be aspects which we haven't mentioned yet, which is around promotion and recognition, so vital for our staff that just as we do with research and scholarly activity and knowledge exchange, that we also recognize innovative leadership, academic leadership, and teaching and learning innovations. And that's something that we've been doing for many years and something that I know sectors are engaging with. And that's something that I think as a sector, the TEF gives us a very good reason for having a confidence in recognizing the excellence that we already have across our universities and across the sector. So those are some of the aspects that we will probably be pulling in to best recognize that wider view at an institutional level of where we are and how those metrics fit within that.
So that's helpful. I guess the one of the key questions is going to be how the submitted evidence is going to be weighed up against the metrics. Which one's going to be more important? And I wonder if I could come to Stephanie. You know, clearly you'll have followed this debate closely, and I wondered if you had a sense of whether this was going to be a metrics-driven exercise, an evidence-driven exercise, or how the two were going to sit together.
I think the two will be sitting together in a balanced way, and I do think, once again, we need to recognise the work of the HEA-PVC network in these discussions and putting forward examples of how best they think this could happen. It's a narrative that will really illustrate that institutions are on a journey, and in terms of teaching excellence, is it an absolute or is it a quest for teaching excellence? And I think Julie's just really, really highlighted there very neatly, a very, very strategic approach in terms of ensuring that the drive never ceases. So in terms of thinking about how that assessment might take place, I think it's already been suggested and stated that the assessment panels will start to be recruited soon. PVCs, such as Julie, will be eligible to put forward for the assessment panels, because I think it's been determined that the assessment panel should be made up from those who understand what teaching excellence is about. It isn't solely about metrics. There has to be that wraparound narrative that really illustrates the diversity of the sector as well. And I think we want to applaud the diversity and the autonomy of the sector. So if, for example, you were to be assessing the metrics and the wraparound narrative of, for example, some of the small and specialists or some of the alternative providers that focus primarily on one particular discipline area, you need a panel that can view that quite differently. The metrics might look different, but it'll be the wraparound narrative that I think will give that sense of whether or not this institution is really taking seriously that drive for teaching excellence. There will be a number of indicators in support of teaching quality, the learning environment, and student outcomes. And, of course, there are the lists as to what evidence might be incorporated, which includes as well professionalisation for teaching and academic support staff, reward and recognition, as Julie highlighted level experience of staff involved in teaching. So all institutions will be able to either draw on the bank of evidence that's suggested in the technical consultation, or there could be other things that they might deem to be more important.
Great, thanks. I think now might be a good time to start taking some questions, because we've had lots of questions in, and a number of them have been about metrics and evidence. So let's start with them, and then perhaps we'll cover some other points around the broader impact of the test in a few moments. A question from Sid Hayes at the University of Brighton. He says, there's no mention in the white paper about any specific metrics relating to staff demonstrating that they have an appropriate teaching qualification to teach. I wonder what the panel feel about that. It seems a little odd that the TEF is all about quality, but currently there's no requirement to have a teaching qualification. I know that this is something that Julie touched on, so I wondered actually if I could come to Stephen Isherwood and put that to you, whether teaching qualifications are something that you think would be useful for academics to have and indeed useful to measure in the TEF, or whether actually the focus for you should be in other areas such as employability and teaching qualifications are a bit of a red herring.
I think it's a tricky one. It's quite interesting when you this angle of the debate, and also you compare it to the debate in schools, because a similar debate rages in schools about qualified, unqualified teachers, etc. And I don't pretend to be an expert. But take it from the employer's point of view. An employer, it's not really that interested in whether actually a teacher needs to be qualified in the subject matter that they're delivering in terms of a teaching. I think the important thing is all the things that Stephanie and Julia talk about, which is around actually being able to get that culture of teaching excellence into the system, so that it's, you know, that it's perceived as important and institutions put their weight behind it. I think one of the difficulties of a teaching qualification, of course, when we tend to lump sort of, you know, higher education into one sort of big bucket as graduates. I mean, I do it all the time about graduate market data, but it's such a diverse offering, you know, from highly vocational subjects to highly academic subjects. You have people going into roles that are highly technical operational delivery, whereas people follow other, you know, very different highly academic routes. And I think trying to put in place a specific measure, right, this is how teaching should be delivered for all that great variety, I'm not sure. My personal view is that might be more of a tick box exercise rather than doing actually what we're aiming to achieve here, which is overall increase the quality of teaching excellence throughout the education system.
Thanks very much, Stephen. I've got a question here from Johnny Rich, and again it's on metrics, and it's on the employment metric. And perhaps Julie may feel well-placed to offer a view on this. Johnny says, given that in a recession employment rates fall, but employability skills rise as people move into training to get jobs or hang on to them, is employment a worthwhile measure of employability?
Right, thank you for that question.
I mean, I guess the question really is, you know, can we use employment as a metric when, you know, it's very dependent on the jobs market. And, of course, there's the issue of then people going back into training during the time of recession. So, you know, is that employment measure useful as it stands?
Yes. No, and I think it's a very, very good point. And it's one that I make all the time, which is we talk about employability, but in many cases, we have to remember that our current generation of university students are all employed. The majority of them have part-time jobs. They have a large amount of transferable skills already. So the key piece for me in many cases is that graduate level employment. And I absolutely agree with the person who put up the question, which is just this blanket employability doesn't best give that view of actually have we best supported our students in feeling confident enough to go forward, step into the employment market, which is appropriate to a graduate. And that doesn't really have to align particularly with the subject area. As Stephen has always eloquently highlighted, the subject area in many cases, it's the skill set which is and the attributes there. So I do think that's one of many of the issues around the DELE. And I think there's also an aspect around the 6 months. I mean, actually, I think most universities are around about 80-odd percent of their students going into employment within 6 months or further study, which is very high. But actually, the key point for me is always getting into that right, that stepping stone into an early stage of what a graduate can do and then onwards. And so certainly I would want to have a metric that better reflected that, and as we've already highlighted, one that was rather more longitudinal, so that the students, particularly from areas which possibly are less vocational, to have some time to best work on where they want to get that professional management or graduate level job. So a very good point, but absolutely right that generally just employability doesn't allow us as a university, and these metrics have got to be ones in which we can impact. And it's extremely hard to have metrics which really we already know have myriad factors which influence them.
Right, and perhaps a final question for the moment, and I'll put this one to Stephanie. It's a question from Paul Fleet, and he raises an interesting point. Paul asks, could a metric capture one of the most essential skills of a graduate, their independence of thought and ability to conduct critical analysis? Stephanie, is that something that really could be captured in a metric?
I would say that's right into the territory of the UK Engagement Survey. I mean, the UK Engagement Survey is looking at course challenge, it's looking at the confidence of a student, and I would say if you were using the UK Engagement Survey, 3 years of the UK Engagement Survey has already taught us that student self-monitoring their progress with that will really, really help their employability skills. We've also found out from a recent correlation study as well that from that engagement survey, there's a real correlation with the CPD of academic staff or those teaching the students, in that those who are qualified to teach, engaged in CPD, do a lot better in being able to change pedagogic approaches to be able to engage their students properly. So I think the question from Paul is very much about student engagement, so that students also can self-monitor and self-assess, which is absolutely crucial in terms of bringing about autonomous learners who are fit for employability.
Great. I mean, perhaps just to return to the main discussion for a moment, I just wanted to get a sense of how the panel thought the impact of the TEF would pan out on the UK higher education sector. Perhaps, Stephanie, if I could start with you. The government has talked a lot about raising the status of teaching in our universities. I just wonder whether you thought, you know, the TEF would achieve that, whether it would be something that universities would really engage with.
I think universities are already engaged, and we certainly know that once again from our PVC network and from our PVC test network that has been instrumental in terms of working up what a model that would really help us achieve the goals that we want to achieve would look like. I think particularly good now you will see that many of the job advertisements are saying that staff should have an HEA fellowship because they want staff who understand what teaching excellence is about. So certainly the spotlight now is the result of all the green, you know, the run-up to the green paper, the consultative process has led there to be an awful lot of dialogue about what is teaching excellence, what does it look like. I think also drawing the parallels then with the ref in terms of looking at where research selectivity was, how that translated into the research assessment framework and then into the ref, really evolving, and what are the different constituent parts. And I think when we're looking at constituent parts, we need to be mindful of 10 years of Graham Gibbs research in this area, where he emphasizes that great teaching is a key driver of student success. So how do we bring about great teaching? And I think if you look at some of the more recent surveys, we know that students want value for money. That's coming out of surveys that have been drawn on, that have helped inform TEF, and they also want trained teachers who are qualified to teach. So I think the TEF is certainly part of the journey. I think institutions have embraced it, but then particularly important is to look at all eyes are on us globally. For years now, we've suggested that our higher education is best in the world. Therefore, how do we actually evidence that? So if step change in our commitment to teaching excellence is a result of the TEF, it's taking us in exactly the right direction to be able to evidence and ensure also that we continue to recruit overseas students internationally and feel we've got some solid evidence behind our statements about come to the UK, we've got the best possible higher education that's on offer in the world.
Thanks, Stephanie. I mean, if that's the sector as a whole, perhaps I could turn to Julie for a sense of what the impact on institutions was likely to be. I wanted to get a sense of how institutions would use their TEF ratings and what actually the impact might be on sort of hierarchy of institutions. In UK higher education, there's a number of universities that for many years have been thought of as the traditional elite. I wondered, Julie, whether you thought that the TEF could really shake that up and indeed put institutions, you know, like your own or like many others, you know, at the top of that tree.
Well, I would certainly like to see Oxford Brookes towards the top of that tree, absolutely, and I think we have the excellence of teaching and learning environment to do that. But I think there's several aspects. I mean, for us, certainly we see the TEF ratings for reputation, for best articulating and highlighting the work that we do strategically to continue to enhance our pedagogic practice, make sure our staff at the fore of what they do, whether that is professional practice within a curriculum or actually the teaching delivery itself, and to celebrate that. So I think for us, we would certainly use that in a reputational aspect. It will be very intriguing to see if students utilize that information in their choice. I think the evidence suggests that certainly hierarchies are rather more historic than league table at this moment in time, and certainly some of the information around KISS isn't best informing, or at least these students are finding it less useful in informing their choice. And so I think in many cases it will be very interesting to see, but I think for most institutions, I don't think they'll, I hope to a certain extent there will not be a major rejigging of, if we talk about the tree as it were, but I think certainly some of our best universities will want to put forward a clear articulation of where that teaching and learning sits within their core business, which of course it does, but most importantly, the excellence of that. So we're not talking about basic quality, which is measured in other ways of doing that, but we're talking about an evidence-based strategic approach to change, to recognizing the needs, to changing needs of students, the changing types of cohorts, the changing requirements from employers and how the universities best respond to that, which they do now, but in a very hidden way. And I certainly hope, and I know that many institutions will relish being able to articulate that against the TEF framework.
A final question from me before we go to some questions from listeners. And it was one for Stephen, actually, because I was interested how Julie talked about how hierarchies and reputations tended to be quite long-standing. And I wanted to get a sense of how you thought the TEF might influence employers' recruitment practices, whether it was likely to make them look afresh, look anew at perhaps universities that aren't part of the traditional elite, or whether recruitment practices were likely still to remain, you know, largely the same.
I don't know is the honest answer, and the reason I don't know is because we don't actually have the data, in a sense, being produced yet. And a lot of it will depend on actually what the data does say, how it changes, you know, prospective students and students' behaviour, and actually what it shows employers in terms of outcomes and what they can engage with. So a lot of it depends on that. So I think there is a significant amount of potential here for employers to engage better. There is already a trend happening, which is employers, the social mobility debate is one of the hottest debates in employment circles at the moment. If you talk about diversity amongst employers, yes, gender, race is still there, but social mobility is where all the noise is. And that's making employers really think quite hard about actually how they recruit, where they target. And we're starting to see some quite innovative practice coming out in a whole number of ways. So my hope is that actually the data the TEF produces, the greater engagement of employers actually on campus, engaged in TEF processes, about feeding back actually what does work as part of the undergraduate experience to create better employment outcomes, the more of a spotlight that shines on that, over time we will see employers involved in their activities. So I think it's very, very difficult to predict because it's very difficult to predict when a lot of this information is very much below the radar at the moment. So it's trying to understand what will happen as it becomes available. But I think the potential is definitely there to drive some considerable change.
Great. I wanted to finish by taking some more questions from listeners. Perhaps I'll start by putting a question from Ryan Owens to Stephanie. He asks, for the sector as a whole, do the panel see the danger that all institutions will simply tick the boxes and be rated outstanding, similar to when nearly all universities found a way to charge £9,000 tuition fees, causing prospective students to lose faith in the system? So I guess there's a question about sort of, you know, everyone sort of a race to the top, sort of all doing the same thing, making sure that you tick the boxes. So Stephanie, do you think that's a risk?
I would suggest that what the assessment panels will be looking for is a narrative explaining what the journey to teaching excellence looks like, which is very much mission aligned. So to a certain extent, you could say there will be some box ticking to a very limited extent, but it will be so nuanced according to all the sliced data, looking at background data, gender, cultural differences, et cetera, but that alignment to the mission. So judgments will be made on that. Also, as a result, what we're hoping and what we're pressing for is that there will be a compendium post the trial, which is test two, they're calling it the trial, aren't they, the pilot, of what best practice looks like and what can be highlighted as also illustrative of diversity within the sector. So I think we'll get that clearer sense that institutions are different, and of course they will be so differentiated by the different commendations. Although there's a list of commendations out there, once again, that's featuring in the technical consultation. So if institutions think that something that they're particularly good at and that's very, very distinctive that isn't in that current list of commendations, they need to feed that in. So I think we will find, well, I would hope that we would find a number that were certainly excellent, but I think it's the commendations that will be a real differentiator and show that it isn't just merely a box-ticking exercise.
Great. A question from Chris Bridges, and I'll put this to Julie, if I may. And perhaps if I could ask the panel to keep their responses relatively succinct as we're reaching the end of the session, I'd like to get at least one or two more questions in. So Julie, Chris Bridges asked, what is the panel's view on the potential disadvantage to part-time or short contract university work with relation to the TEF, especially on women and young researchers? Are they likely to find themselves at a disadvantage as a result of the TEF coming in?
Well, I would certainly hope not, and I think that's part of the work that we would probably want to be seeing if you're talking about, you know, a rich learning environment that supports the diversity of students and role models. We would expect to have a very rich narrative which would discuss involvement with Athena Swan and what are we doing around making sure that our staff are aligning well with the students in front of them, because we know that that has a very, very causal link with attainment and having that range of role models. So I would certainly expect it not to have that effect, and I would be very concerned if we felt that it would do, because it is about reflecting what we currently do, and therefore the, you know, the richness of our own staff base is part and parcel of the excellence that we should be articulating.
Great.
I just come in there. Sorry, can I just come in briefly there, Chris?
Of course,
I was going to say, if I take a view from the corporate sector, actually, I think the situation for those groups will improve because it's about shortage of talent and the focus on teaching excellence and where do you find the people with those skills. And if you take a corporate view, actually, you have to have a very broad net to get that range of people, so it should actually have a positive effect.
Great. And Stephen, I was just going to put the final question to you before I wrap up. And this was a question from Paul Kleinman. It says, students join or study courses or programs. How will institution-wide assessment of teaching quality help them know about teaching quality of their particular choice of degree course? Do you think that these institution-level results will be useful, or is it only going to be useful when we get the subject results, Stephen?
Only really useful when it gets to subject results. I think the institution level, one of my disappointments, I understand getting it right and taking time 4 years away, That bothers me that it takes so long to get to discipline level. I think people will need it at discipline institution level. That's where it becomes meaningful around student choices. Institution level is too generic a number, too generic a rating.
Great. Well, thanks for your time there. And sadly, that's all we've got time for. Sorry that there were some questions that we didn't get a chance to get to, but hopefully we've covered a lot of the key issues around the test. Of course, the debate doesn't end here. For the latest news, analysis and comment on the test, you can see www.timeshighereducation.com. In addition to that, the Higher Education Academy is developing a range of resources and support for universities in relation to the test. The link for that is heacademy.ac.uk/TES test. And if you want to explore the data that will form the test and its likely impact on the sector, Times Higher Education is holding a data symposium in London on June the 23rd. The details for that are at timeshighereducation.com/globalHERace. But now I'd like to take the opportunity to thank the panel for their contributions. It's been a fascinating debate. And to wish everyone listening them all well with their test submissions. Thanks very much for listening to this webinar from Times Higher Education and the Higher Education Academy.